Tonight on Overdue Rentals, we're speaking with Senator Ted Kennedy, ex-President Ronald Reagan, and star of Late Night with the Devil, and writer and star of 2014's Animals, Mr. David Dasmalchian. And what have all these people have in common? They've all been to hell. Here on Overdue Rentals. Welcome back to Overdue Rentals, everybody, the show where we talk about films that we feel didn't get enough attention at one point. Maybe they did get a lot of attention, but they need more again. I'm Matthew Shuckman.
And I'm CineBlend's Mike Reyes.
And today, everybody, please, it's such a wonderful joy to have David Dasmalchian with us. You know, somebody, a guy who a lot of people, some maybe only know his face, they don't know his name. Some people may know his name, but not his face. I don't know what I'm saying at this point. Everybody knows this. Everybody knows David.
And oh, yeah.
He's somebody that has gotten a lot of... He's been in some major films, getting a lot of press, but there's still people who are yearning for more leading roles for David. And we're about to talk about two of them tonight. One new, one not only older, but one that he wrote based on... partially his own life, which is something that some people may be surprised by. I don't know. We'll find out if you know or not about the man's past.
Ooh, that's mysterious.
Did you know beforehand or no?
Yes, I did know beforehand because I believe I'd seen it in passing, and then know it, and then seeing the subject matter for Animals, it's like, oh, I wonder if he pulled on. And it turns out that was built off of his own personal experiences with addiction, as you will find out on here, ladies and gentlemen. But also, the man's just a powerhouse in Late Night with the Devil as well, which is this wonderful horror film that will be coming to theaters on Friday, March 22nd, but will also be on Shudder April 19th. I suggest you see it both ways. Yes. And I wish I had not gotten the invite for last Friday's screening in New York earlier, because there was a screening the day that we did our interviews in person, and they were doing a Jack Delroy pre-taping, and I think that's why David was in the city, because he showed up as Jack Delroy.
I didn't even think I saw that. Probably, you know, because we got the invitation for everything else ahead of time.
Yeah.
It was just like, all right, we're doing this. No need to do everything else.
And also, if I had gotten that invite ahead of time, I probably could have made it into the city. We probably could have sat down with David in person.
Yeah, that would have been nice.
But that just means we need to get him back. It's like, look, David, you want to... I mean, I don't know if he's fully based in L.A. now, but, you know, you're from the Allentown, Pennsylvania region. We are East Coast boys. I'm sure we could find somewhere in Jersey or Pennsylvania that we could all converge and just have fun.
Well, more importantly, if he is L.A.-based, he's going to have a sit-down soon and be Conan O'Brien's friend.
Oh, yes. Mr. O'Brien, sir, please interview David Dasmalchian and then come be on our show.
But now let's not waste any more time. Let's get the gentleman in here to talk about these movies. And then we'll be back shortly after to discuss further, like we always do.
Dear listeners, please welcome David Dasmalchian to the Overdue Rentals counter. David, is that a Black Parade top you're wearing?
No, it's Dave Dasmalchian. He stole it from me for the Black Parade video. No, I love that video, by the way. I fucking love that song, and I love that video so much. When I saw this is a designer in LA named Johnny Coda, and I saw this and I go, oh my god, it's the Black Parade, and I bought it immediately, and I love it.
Well, thank you for joining us so we can talk about all of this. We really appreciate it. It's lovely to see you.
Thanks, man. It's great to see you too.
Look, I just want to jump off and quickly ask, because, you know, there's two movies technically going on here in my mind, because there is the, we'll call it horror story for to make it easy, but there is a talk show going on, and we all kind of grew up watching talk shows. So was it easy to kind of jump into that persona from memory, or did you actually go and study people that you kind of wanted to play off of a little bit?
Dude, it was as hard as you saying to me, hey man, we want you to play the lead in a new film about a figure skater. I mean, it scared me so bad. The thought of trying to convince an audience that I was a real talk show host was so intimidating to me just because it in my memory, and I wasn't wrong, there is, just like when you go see really good stand-up or when you watch even today's, you know, legendary late night host, there is a whole presentation, there's a whole form to it that is so distant from what I try to do as an actor, which is trying to strip away performance, trying to be as naturalistic mm-hmm. as possible. So fortunately, because I love this project so much and I wanted to get it right, I had the benefit of a couple months before we went to shoot it. So I just spent every night before bed watching all of the old talk shows, totally pulling in as much inspiration as I could. I thought a lot about the ways that people have portrayed talk show hosts and that energy on TV and in films. And I just kept searching for the voice, the stance, the way that they use their hands, the way that they use their pockets, the way they use their suit jackets. Some of those masters like Letterman, Conan. I mean, do you remember Conan with all the ways he would use his cost, his suit?
The strings,
man. He snip, whoop. I mean, by the way, somebody needs to get this interview to Conan O'Brien. I need to go on his podcast someday too and say, I want to talk about like that, all that stuff, the minutia of the years I spent watching him and how it helped me with this performance, because yeah, it was not easy. And you say there's two movies in this movie. I couldn't agree more. And that's one of the things that enticed me as well about the challenge of performing Jack Delroy, because I had to be Jack, the public persona, which I can relate to as Dave. I have a public persona. I have a person that I want you all to like, be intrigued by, be entertained by. I want you to buy my comic books. I want you to come and see the movies that I make. I want you to, you know, respond to what it is that I'm trying to share. And then there's Dave that wants no one to see any part of him. There's the Dave that wants to, that is alone. And even though this is an extreme and magnified set of circumstances, I genuinely think it's something that all of us can relate to, whether you're in the entertainment industry or not. So the making of these two movies, the one behind the scenes and the one in front of the camera, was so challenging, so scary, but also one of the most gratifying parts of the process.
No, absolutely. And just watching how it all comes together is insane. And even before reading the director's statement, and even before Matthew telling me, I believe we're going to have the directors at some point, and their Overdue Rental is a network, even before knowing why we chose that, watching this movie, like right from the beginning, you have that Michael Ironside like narration that just right from there, it's like, oh, now I see why networks linked into this. And just having that sort of cultural touchstone in my mind, as well as being a huge fan of Carson and a huge fan of, you know, all the masters, as you put them, just having those cultural touchstones didn't hinder this. It just made it even greater.
Thanks, man. Thank you. I'm so hopeful that people who watch this, whether they have a personal connection to the old days of late night talk shows or not, will find a way. And there's so many paths in. Cameron and Colin did such a fantastic job. They created one path in, which is that nostalgia, that sense of like, oh my God, this really feels and looks like the shows that I remember. There's that shock value sense that kind of evokes the old energy of like, you know, early Morton Downey Jr. and stuff. There's also that like wonderful element of, for the horror hounds, the practical effects, the core, the monstrosities that we get to watch unfold. And then there is that like quick banter patter of the drama, the heightened sense of of stake increases that are taking place every commercial break, that evoke every, you know, Paddy Chayefsky or John Cazal type of storytelling. So I'm glad you're going to talk to Colin and Cameron about Network, which is a big influence on our film, but also just because they're such great guys. We mostly talked when we were doing the film about, we would just nerd out. We would end up getting sidetracked and forget about the movie we're making and start talking about, do you remember the Fangoria issue when John Carpenter had the thing? And we'd be like, oh man, do you remember that great We just like, there's such nerds like me for horror. It was the best.
This industry seems to breed that, especially the horror genre. It just feels like so many of the people that came up on Fangoria or Tales.
You know what
the
was
Crypt
awesome too? I'm friends with Fangoria and host the Chainsaw Awards. I make content with them. So when I told them what fans Colin and Cameron were, as well as our makeup department and stuff, I got this big swag box. And day one of filming, I was able to go around to all the departments and give them, you know, magazines. And there's even we even shot some still photos of me with like vintage, like Jack Delroy, even though it's 1977 precedes Fangoria. We art department made some 1977 issue Fangoria magazines that we took pictures of me and the boys reading. That's together. Nice. Really awesome.
That's great. That's the other thing too, about, because we're going into those horror aspects of the movie, because there is so much that is practical. I mean, especially the worm kind of stuff when you get in there later on. But is there also a sense that this felt like, I'm not saying you shot it, you know, chronologically, but you felt like you were also trying to film a talk show. So it felt like long takes, no gaps, you know, just kind of going through this from step A to step B.
That was really scary and really hard, but it also made me so grateful for the years that I spent as like a Chicago theater actor. Doing this movie felt like being back at the Victory Gardens Theater in a Shattered Globe production of like Sam Shepard's Buried Child, or doing one of those storefront theater plays, because there I was 5 feet away from the audience, getting to interact with people in a way that you can only get in the theater. And Colin and Cameron so smartly made sure to pack the risers with people. Yes. To give me that energy, give me that response. And all of my fear about the fact that I was going to completely shit the bed when I had to get up there and do this opening monologue as Jack Delroy was, it just lifted off of me when I landed that first joke. And I call him Sticks, the drummer in the band, gave me a good shot. Yeah. And people started laughing and I started grooving with that energy and, you know, like just improvising and talking to people. And I even did little like Easter egg shout outs and improvs referencing things like Sven Gulli and stuff. It just became so fun. And it felt like I was back on stage. So these long ass takes, which can really be scary for an actor, were freeing. And I fuck up a lot. If you watch that opening monologue, when we get into the night of October 31st, 1977, there's certainly mistakes that I was made, but I felt safe enough and comfortable enough within those that they just rolled into little bits and little, you know, it's fun.
Well, we here on Overdue Rentals also like to talk about films we don't feel have gotten enough love, or maybe they were big at one point and just people need to be reminded of them. And we wanted to talk about the 2014 film Animals with you, which you happen to have written. And by the way, can I just say to you, the thing that I love most about this movie is, obviously, you just mentioned the log line to someone and they're immediately going to think, oh, it's a Requiem for a Dream or something along those lines. But there is so much more tenderness, but yet so much more heartbreak to this movie.
Thanks, man. Thank you. I wanted to make, they say, write what you know. And I, at this point, had not acted in a very long time. I got clean. I was a heroin addict and I nearly lost my life. And I got clean May 10th, 2002. So 22 years ago this year. But I, when I got clean, I never imagined that I'd go back to being an actor. And after a number of years of learning how to live a sober life, I started writing because I needed a creative outlet. And they say to write what you know. And I was really wanting to tell a story about codependency and about being in love with someone and wondering if that love is actually going to kill you, because the heart can be such a fucking monster sometimes, right? And I knew that if I wrote what I knew, it was A, codependency, and B, addiction. And addiction is such a fantastic metaphor for codependency, because it's a physical dependency upon mm-hmm. something. It's like being in love with a in a dysfunctional relationship can feel like a physical dependency. So going in to write and tell that story was one of the scariest things I ever did. I am so grateful. Thank God every day that I did it. It brought together a group of incredible artists that made no money. I'm so proud of what we were able to achieve. And thanks for wanting to give it a little spotlight for a second, because I think that at the end of the day, whether people have an experience or history with addiction or not, which I think most people do, just maybe not in the extremes of this film, I really am proud of it. And I hope that this episode leads people to go discover the film. Kim Shaw is just brilliant in the role of Bobby. Colin Shipley did such a beautiful job directing the film. Our cinematographer, our production designer, our costume, our makeup, everyone involved brought this A++++ game to a film where no one made shit. There was seven of us living in a one bedroom apartment. I could only afford an Airbnb for me, my wife, Eve, who is not in, she is in film now, but she's a fabricator and a sewer. But at the time she was a bartender, and she came and was our artistic director, our art director, helping Katie Birmingham, who was our production designer. It was me, Eve, makeup artist, she did such a great job. That was her first film, Amber Tallarico. Our director, Colin Shifley, our cinematographer, Larkin Donnelly, our production designer, Katie Birmingham, and our first AD, my dear friend, Laura, all of us together in a one bedroom apartment. That meant the shower schedule was so overwhelming that I took a shower once a week because I was so tired, because I was doing like 16 hour days, considering I'd have to go back to the office and get prepped for the next day and put things together. It was nuts, but I don't regret a minute of it.
But at least had that one scene where you had to shower in the film. So you had that day to,
That genuinely, I don't think I had showered for like a week before that. And that scene, we were at a YMCA, on the south side of Chicago. And we really wanted it to be, I filmed that completely naked, and we wanted that scene to be filled with steam. So they turned it up as hot as it would go, all the showers, to get the steam going. But then we were running out of time because we'd also been shooting in the pool, because we shot the pool scene. And so it was like, we're running out of time. We got to shoot. So then they turned the hot water down, but for whatever reason, the pipes were so old that the scalding hot would not turn off. So I had to go in there and do this scalding hot water, totally naked, and just have to act like I was getting clean for the first time. You know, it was nuts.
Oh man. But again, that's just death dedication right there. I'm sorry. Like, it's almost like those stories about when Hugh Jackman discovered his Wolverine growl because he accidentally took a cold shower.
Yes.
Like, just, I love little things like that where it's like, okay.
Yeah.
So this isn't really good in the moment, but this is going to work so well when it goes on screen.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I drove my wife crazy at one point because I insisted on having a baby pool filled with ice during the scenes where I'm kicking in the hospital. Cause I kicked heroin a number of times in my life. And the last time, that's not true. One of the last times I did it was strapped to a bed at a psych facility called Reed Hospital in Chicago. And we were shooting at a place not far from Reed, actually, an old abandoned nursing home. And I'm, you know, supposed to be going through the withdrawals of opiate withdrawal sickness. And I asked for, baby pool filled with ice, and I would lay in it in my underwear. And then I'd come out and start shaking. It's like, oh, David, kind of an idiot, but it was still fun.
Talking about Colin, though, too, because he's basically directed, whether it's short or feature length, everything, I think everything you've written at this point. Was he somebody that you've been friends with for a while and felt comfortable that he's able to tell your story this way? Or was it something that, again, you teamed up one time and it just worked out well, so you kept going?
So when I had done The Dark Knight, I was still in Chicago doing some theater before I was going to try my hand at, I went and lived in New York for a year. And then from New York, I went to LA. But in like 2008, Colin was a senior at Columbia College Chicago Film School. and he was making his like practicum film, and someone had reached out to see if I would star in this film about a plant that's a man that grows out of this garden, and it's kind of this weird, surreal, creepy thing. And I loved the script and I loved working with him, and we became good friends. And then we moved out to LA around the same time. And I was struggling so much to find work and opportunities to be an actor when I got to LA, couldn't really get, you know, any breaks. And I thought, well, I'm not just going to sit around. I want to make stuff. So we just started making short films and making short films. And then when I wrote the script for, I had written the script for Animals at that point, and I didn't know what to do with it. And I did a commercial with an amazing director named Chris Smith. Chris, who had made a film called American Movie, which is one of my favorite documentaries of all time.
We did an episode on it. Yep.
It's a masterpiece. Chris loved the script so much. He called me from London where he was shooting something. And he said, David, we got to make this movie. It's brilliant. So he was going to direct it for a minute. And then he came to the conclusion that his schedule was so slammed, it would be a couple of years before he could do it. But Colin and I had been putting together a book of imagery and ideas. And Chris looked at Colin's book and he was like, why don't you direct a movie? You've got a great vision for it. And so that's what we did, and went and got a great producer named Mary Pat Bentel, who had made a bunch of really cool indie films and really loved the script. And we just went like maniacs and did this movie with next to nothing.
And it's just so amazing because, again, you normally when you look at an actor's resume, it's like, oh, this was the hit before, this was the one before the hit. But like, you were in Dark Knight at this point. And then it was like a couple of years later, it's like Animals is like, oh, I did not expect the timeline to play out that way. But it makes it, it just makes it so even more interesting. Like, what about that experience do you think helped you most going back to, you know, making your own indie script?
So getting to be around an auteur, a master like Chris Nolan was so inspiring to me because it only reaffirmed what I already knew to be true from a very small scale and being around the really great masterful directors I'd worked with on stage in Chicago. And that was that vision, talent, preparation, all of the abilities that were taking place on the set of a massive giant Hollywood film in such a beautiful way were going to translate to the way we were going to need to pull off making even a very small film. Communication, vision, clarity of vision, tonal understanding. Art in cinema doesn't go anywhere unless tonal consistency is the lens through which the entire film is made. And I just knew that if we could beat out everything and we could really think through everything and every shot, we knew what every scene meant. We understood what it meant, the color of the palette of the world we were creating, and everyone was on the same page, that we could really make something special. And I'm glad that you guys think that we did. I like to think we did.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, that's the other thing too, especially with somebody like you who has a career where almost everybody in the world definitely knows who you are in some way or another. I still think there are people, unless they've seen something like Animals, unless they've seen something like Late Night with the Devil, they still don't know what your natural voice sounds like and stuff like that. So it's great to have these things also there to say like, this is David.
It's great when someone meets me like, wait, you're not a hairless mentat?
Oh, I wish we had more time to dive into like Denis Villeneuve's
story.
Well,
I guess I'll have to come back.
You of course have a standing invitation because anyone who's friends with Sven Gulli is friends with us. No, not just anybody on that show.
And choose whatever film you want to talk about. It doesn't have to be your career. You want to talk about something that you loved as a kid, loved as an adult, doesn't get attention? We'll talk about it all day.
I love it. Well, thanks for this amazing show. You guys are awesome. Thanks for showing so much love to both Late Night with the Devil and Animals, two of my proudest accomplishments as an actor in my life. So it means the world to me. And we're a tiny film. You know, we don't have money. We're not on billboards all over this place. So it's like, without you, audiences don't find this film. So thank you. It means a lot to me.
We'll get it out there. We'll get everything to Conan as well. Don't worry about it. We'll find a way.
Don't forget. You said it.
Stay safe, sir. Have a good one.
You as well. Thanks, have a great one.
Bye.
Bye. David Dastmalchian, which I also, I also, I, I, you know, I think everybody always tries to figure out if they say his name right or not. I always thought it was, to me, I would pronounce it Dust Malgian because I am Shuckman with a CH for the K sound. But I think he is David Dust Malgian, actually.
Oh, I could be wrong. I could very much be
wrong.
You know,
he said it at the opening of our interview. We should just go back and listen to him say it.
Yeah, but it's David Dust Malgian. You're watching him and you're just listening and it's like, it's just a joy to watch him talk about the stuff that, because he's another one of our people that just gets it.
Well, he's also somebody that is definitely, how do I put it?
So damn personable.
If he wasn't somebody who was writing and or starring in movies, you know, I mean, he may have had a different job or something like that, whatever it may be, but he's like, he's basically us. He's kind of, and I don't mean like me and you specifically. He's like one of the ilk of, you know, just like, I loved all these strange kind of things when I was young and I championed them and now yeah. I get to do them kind of thing.
I could imagine a young David just going into the video store and grabbing whatever he could. And then, you know, just all of the horror stuff that we were talking about, like, especially with horror, like the dude is just, I mentioned the fact that we talked to David to a friend of mine at Fangoria. And like I got one of the coolest messages back. He's like, he's my boy. And it's like, yeah.
Well, he mentioned he's friendly with everybody.
Well, that's exactly what I mentioned. I was like, look, we got David on the show recently. He gives a lot of love to Fango in our new episode. So I would love to get my, I'm going to have to ask my friend if he wants to come on here. I think he would.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, but that's just, it's just cozy. It's like, especially it feels like the horror geeks that are really in the, like, the Fangorias and the Rue Morgues of the world. And just, you know, like I said, the man's been on Svengoolie. And Svengoolie doesn't just let anybody on that show. Let me tell you that.
Yeah, but, you know, in the same breath, it's not like, I was trying to make a bad Conan O'Brien joke and my brain just shut down because we would do the whole Conan O'Brien thing earlier. So sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, that really does need to happen, though. I would love to hear a Conan David interview.
We'll do everything we can to make it happen, even though we don't have much power.
I'm Richard D. Grant's agent, for crying out loud.
But Late Night with the Devil, you know, is definitely something that has, you know, even though it's played festivals and a lot of people have seen it, it's just like striking up a storm, you know, big time. And I'm going to be interested to see what happens when it officially comes out. And when the rest of the audience get to see it, because I'm wondering if it's going to be a case where maybe people are getting too hyped, you know, and then they're going to go and see it and they're going to go, oh, I don't know, you know, but there's plenty in there to tantalize them.
See, I'm thinking / hoping it's going to be one of those cases where it's just building this slow buzz and it's just going to explode when it comes out, because you've got people that are really amped for this movie. But then again, that does sort of play into your side of the fence there, where it's like, if people get too amped up, their expectations may be different. I personally loved every second of it. It was, and then just hearing David compare it to his theatrical experience, because that was exactly the sort of thing I wanted to mention. But since he already mentioned, it's like,
yeah,
when you have an interview with someone and they already call out one of the shots you want to put out there, it's like, okay, we don't have to dwell on that too much, because you're doing it for me, man. You're giving me what I need. It's definitely, it is theater. And just the care in the long takes. And I love the fact that he even just admitted that, like, he would fuck up some of his lines, but he worked with it. And it's like, okay, they're really working with this live TV ecosystem.
Well, it's also very nice to hear that literally the audience was there for the whole thing. You know, the audience are technically part of the movie in the sense where, like, even when they're not on the screen, they're there witnessing everything. So it's like the experience must have felt like a very, like a theater-esque type of performance.
And they had a real band there and everything. And it's like, I dig that dedication. And again, the fact that I did not know going into this that Network was a direct source, or direct influence going into this with that knowledge, it was just like, oh, this is a nice cheesy slice of pizza for me.
Well, it's such an interesting thing, because, you know, for people who know or who don't or aren't sure, you know, we put out these feelers for the interviews, and, you know, sometimes depending on somebody's background, if they don't have a certain amount of things that fit into the genre of what we think the overdue rental is, so it's not their career, we'll say, hey, let them choose a movie they want to talk about. But when, because we're going to most probably be talking to, as you're listening to this, we may very well be talking to the directors, the writers and directors of this movie. And I remember watching the movie and then immediately going, you know what? Tell them we want to talk about Network as the overdue rental. I think it'll fit. I think they'll like it. Not realizing that it's actually part of like the press release. It's like, it is an influence. Part of that is an influence, not necessarily to the whole story, but to both presentation and maybe a little bit of what we'll call mass perception kind of side of things. So yeah, it was so interesting to hear that back saying like, okay, it's always nice to when you feel something and then you are validated that your feelings were correct.
Oh yeah, just like watching the movie and you have Chris Du and I'm forgetting his name now.
Carmichael the Conjurer?
Carmichael Haig, right?
Well, I mean, I am...
Well, Carmichael. Yeah, you have Chris Du and Carmichael. And watching that whole thing go off, it's like, wait a minute. Is this what I think it is? And then sure enough, after the movie, I read the press release and it's like, the director's notes, and it's like, oh, it's James Randi and it's Uri Geller.
Well, I mean, to me, it's like, that's like 100%. Like, unless you don't know, like, you can tell the amazing Randi in there. You can see it. Especially when they start to try to debunk stuff. It's too much of a, like, not like super obvious kind of thing, but it's obvious, you know? It's something that is, you know, if you're in the know, whether you've seen An Honest Liar itself or just know James Randi's work in general, and a lot of his clips circulate on social media now for people who don't know it, like, you can tell. It's like, yeah, there you go. That's the whole James Randi thing.
Yeah. But, I think this will be another one I will keep on hand for a Halloween holiday. I mean, I want to watch it the rest of the year, but definitely since it is tied into Halloween so directly, it'll be like trick or treat where it's like, I want this especially for the Halloween season.
Did you watch the trailer beforehand?
I don't only watch the trailer. There are two different variants and... But depending on how schedules shake out and if we talk to the directors, one of the things I want to talk to them about is the fact that there was two different teasers that I saw. Okay. There's one where it's presented as straight up footage from the show, like an ad. And then there's another one where it's a more traditional trailer that has like the pull quotes and it has quotes from all over the film. And I really like the in-universe, like, it has a building sense of dread, but it doesn't have the branding on it. And it's a very cool reel of footage. And I like that one better, of course.
Because I like always, did not watch any trailers, didn't know it. I knew the title of the movie. I knew David was starring in it. And the only thing I had seen was the small visual clip of when it looks like he's interviewing himself. And so I went into the movie thinking I was going to be watching an entire movie of just somebody literally sitting down with somebody who claims the devil, but it's himself the whole time. So I didn't know the rest of everything else that was kind of going to come out of this when I sat down to watch it.
Yeah. No, and I really liked, I guess I know we have to really get onto animals, which that's not a bad thing, but just what, I guess one of the last things I'll say about Late Night with the Devil, I really dug this. I'm sorry.
No, I mean, we're going to talk about animals. Don't worry. It's not like we have to at a certain point and just go boop.
I also really dug animals, but we'll get into that in a moment. But the thing that I just really liked hearing David talk about was working on that host persona.
Yeah.
And that's another one where it's not an easy feat. Like, you could very easily just throw on a name and ham it up in front of a camera and you think, oh, that's a talk show host. But Jack Delroy, like, first of all, I love that they throw in the whole fact that he's like one of Carson is like his nemesis. Like, if he could hunt Johnny Carson down with a spear gun, he probably would have done it.
Well, I mean, they're rivals.
Yeah, but you just tell that, like, he really did his homework when it came to host. Like, he was mentioning all these different things and it's like, he does the whole baseball gag where he gets like the sound effects and the music cues. And it's like, it just reminded me of Johnny Carson with the golf club.
Yeah.
Like, that was Johnny's thing. And you could just imagine Jack being like, well, maybe it's the golf club. Maybe I need something like that to kind of like endear me with the folks. Maybe that'll push us up a little.
I do have to watch it again, though, because there are things to me that are still obvious. Like, I don't have to, like, confirm them, but I would like to dive deeper into spreading apart where I found, I don't want to ruin anything, I guess, for people who haven't seen it.
I think I know where you're going, and suffice it to say, there are Easter eggs in this film.
Well, what do you think? I will decide if we can cut this or not based on, what do you think I'm thinking about?
I think you're thinking about various different little Easter eggs that were in there, like during the first scene with the young girl contacting the other side. If you look at that table and look at that black orb, there's the face. There's a face in there.
I was thinking much more of more story theme messaging in terms of the fact that, you know, because. OK, here's where it pause. If I keep this in. And then come back in 2 minutes, if I do keep it in. If not, you never hear this.
You are the editor.
No, because I was gonna say, when this demon is manifested, if you want to call it the devil or not, because I can't remember if we named it specifically. It says,
it's
"Hey
Braxis,
again."
I think. I
only got 2 minutes, so. It says, you know, "Hi again, Jack," as if they met before. Because all the allusions to his meetings in the woods was his wife's cancer was him kind of like a genie that gives you bad wishes. He says, "I need better ratings." And so the way he gave it better ratings was giving his wife cancer so that he could use that for his ratings.
Oh yeah, total monkey's paw.
Yeah, so that was kind of what I was alluding
to. Oh no,
to.
I absolutely believe that. Yeah, magic comes at a cost, folks. Be very careful when you're making wishes to deities and sacrifices and all that sort of thing.
And monkey paws.
But I think, they may have been worshipping Abraxas at the lodge.
It was Abraxas, though. You were right, yeah.
Because I think that's who they were worshipping. And then Mr. Wriggles was one of the deities that's like a subjugate of Mr. of Abraxas. I don't remember either. We're going to have to go back and watch it.
Why isn't it not just Abraxas?
Abraxas gets busy. It's anyway. He had his own TV movie at that point. In the beginning, you see the listing and it says, "Oh, this week's TV movie, Hail Abraxas." He's busy. He's got shit to do. It's satanic panic, baby.
I will also admit that I got very confused at the very beginning when they announced the guests, because I don't know if I wasn't paying attention for 5 seconds. Or something happened, but because when they announced the guests and they said Lily, but they were talking about the author at the time, like it didn't, like I just like, wait, what did I miss? Oh no! And I didn't want to go back. I just let it keep going, and then you know, it all laid out after that point. So I wasn't that worried, but it did throw me for a loop for like 5 seconds.
But yeah, just electrifying watching. Very good. Just I love this movie. This was a lot of fun.
But then there's also animals to talk about.
Which is excellent in its own way, because this is not, I mean, this is excellent and electric watching in its own way, but it's not Late Night with the Devil where you're like, that's obviously genre fare. This is very much grounded personal drama.
I constantly forget that we didn't talk about the synopsis for these movies. So people may be listening to this going like, what are they talking now? But Late Night with the Devil, if you're listening to this, I don't think you need the synopsis. You know already. You know?
Halloween night, 1977. Jack Delroy is going to make television history if it kills him.
But Animals, while being a fictitious drama at its core for a watching experience, is a movie about two heroin addicts who basically just are trying to figure their way day to day for how they can, you know, trick people or con people into giving them money so they can feed their habit, and then, you know, how it affects both of them and this relationship. But it is semi-autobiographical because David did suffer with those addictions before, and wrote this screenplay that he stars in.
Yeah, and like I had mentioned to David in the interview, I was kind of surprised that this had already happened after he had done Dark Knight,
yeah,
with Christopher Nolan, and he's done Prisoners with Denis Villeneuve. It's like he was establishing himself as an actor. Like normally, this is something like I guess like Vin Diesel Strays, where it's like, oh, this is like one of the indie movies that they. I think Vin Diesel did Strays before he became a big star.
I don't even know what this is.
But it's I don't even remember if that, I think that's Vin Diesel. But anyway, it's just like it's, you would think it's one of those indie movies that all of a sudden when the star makes it big, it's like they put it back on shelves and there's like a new cover with like a photo that's like hyping them up, when even if it wasn't their movie, it's like, yeah, Robert Downey Jr. and James Spader were in this movie called Tough Turf. You're going to watch it now.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to get off topic now, because I was looking up Vin Diesel's Strays, which was, you're right, it's 1997, but I do want to say that eventually we do have to do an Overdue Rental about Boiler Room.
Oh, yes.
But back to more important business. What you mentioned also during the interview, which I also found interesting, because, again, it's not like, especially since you are left with a little bit of ambiguity to where their roads go at the end. I don't know if he goes with her or not. He may do his own thing, kind of thing. But it's much more, I mean, it's so weird to say, because there's obviously so much going on that is so, dark, but you know, it is and they're not perfect, you know, especially his reactions to certain things can be extremely selfish. But it is a loving couple at the end of the day. And there is a compassionate relationship going on at the end of the day. And the one thing I didn't get to mention, which I also thought, which is, you know, kind of part of it, is the fact that, because her name, her character name is Bobby, but he only calls her Bob. And there was something about that I found not necessarily endearing, but it was just like showing like kind of this familiarity they both have with each other, no matter what, and where, you know, it's a person always to each other, not just a body to be there.
Oh yeah, no, that was something that I really liked about this, and it's been a while since I've seen the bits of Rec Room for a Dream that I did see.
Wait, whoa! I'm sorry. I know I'm cutting in. So now I'm confused. Are you saying you've never seen all of Requiem for a Dream?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
No, I know I have to. I know I have to put myself through that horrible, soul-punishing experience. And I don't say that against the movie. I'm saying it's...
Can I ask a question as to what you have seen?
The ending.
Okay.
I know I need to watch the wind-up. I need to watch the wind-up and the pitch before they get to the score. But I understand that is a film that is very heightened reality and sort of flashier, and the bigger crash at the end. But with animals, I feel like it's still very poignant, very effective in what it says and what it does, but it's gentler with its characters, and it's not the simple tropes of, oh yeah, I mean, yeah, they do both just want to get their fix, but they do love each other, or it seems like they do, yeah, love each other, and there is that gentleness with them, and yeah, there is very selfish behavior and very sort of, you know, very, very drug motivated behavior, like to get to the next score, but they don't care for each other any less. And I liked that it's a movie that keeps that in mind. You don't have to, you feel sorry for these people, but it's not just feeling pity for them, and it's, yeah, not just misery porn. And that is something that someone without those experiences, I think, is very apt to do. And I love how David put that care in there.
Well, there's, I will say two things. One, going back again, back to like the idea that there is selfishness, because again, the main thing I will go back to, because there's plenty of examples, but the main thing I go back to is like when she's taking the pregnancy test, of course he doesn't know she's taking it. But when he opens the door, he sees the cocaine.
Yeah.
And she's always talking about the pregnancy thing. And he's like, you don't like cocaine.
I like coke.
I like cocaine. And he's just staring at it. And it's just like, because that's not a good thing in any way whatsoever. But then again, you know, like, once you get past that, you know, there is still that relationship they do have. And you can't take that away what was presented. And then going to your point again also about saying that there's hope in this and not in Requiem for a Dream, that's because, you know, this movie is more of a hopeful thing and is a hopeful thing because of, especially since we know what happened to David's life. But both the film and the book, Requiem for a Dream, the theme is literally hope is the most dangerous and addictive drug there is in the world. So yeah. It's going to be dark because it crushes you. So, yeah, I mean, obviously there's going to be a big difference.
Yeah, and I mean, just Kim Shaw's performance in that scene that you mentioned is one of the most heartbreaking things because it takes that left turn where it's like, oh, okay, she's pregnant. She's worried about this. But instead, it pivots to this thing where she's like, it's supposed to be blue or pink. It's yellow. And all I'm thinking of is her body chemistry is probably so wrecked by the drugs that it's like, oh, no. Like,
yeah, it's a really subtle thing. And it goes by quickly enough where if you're not paying attention, just don't get it, you're going to be like, what? Well, you're going to make some bad joke, you know, and be like, oh, is she pregnant from The Simpsons or some shitty, stupid thing? Not realize that, yes, it's like the pregnancy test and the test to see if a drug is real or not, they're litmus tests. They're both the same thing, just with different chemicals. So, yeah, you're going to be so affected that you wouldn't be able to tell. Yeah,
Well, this movie thrives on little touches like that. Like the first time we see them, I only saw the synopsis and then I'm watching it and they're in the apartment. I'm like, wait a minute. I thought these two were supposed to be like homeless and penniless, like it says in the thing. And then sure enough, they are in the car.
Yeah.
But that's just their headspace of where they are. And I love that little detail.
Great transition.
Fantastic transition. Where it's like one minute you see them in like this nice apartment and, you know, there's like red walls and curtains. And then like it's as simple as you see them getting ready in the morning and then taking off the window shades. And it's like, oh, now I see it. And I just, again, advocate for going in as cold as you can. And just advocate for having details like these where you're not getting hit over the head. It is very much trusting the viewer. But also just a good touch.
It's also, I mean, this is now completely on a different type of the field, I would say, but it's also nice to, I mean, not anymore, unfortunately, since he passed away, but it's always nice to see John Hurd and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and also John Hurd being the most gentle that he may have ever been in anything he's ever done in his career.
Oh, yeah. That was a really nice thing to see because it's like, okay, like for a minute, I thought he was one of the Johns, and it's like
the guy who really was gonna be do I not recognize him maybe, and he sounds different. I agree, it was the same thing.
Yeah, and it's like he's so in the shadows and it's like, okay, is that him or is that not him? But then when he came on later, it's like, oh no, that's him. And oh, that is that was really affecting to have him in that role. But this is, again, it's just a very, I don't say simple in a bad way, but it's a very simple in concept and execution, but it dives deep for the people that are in it.
It does everything that you would need it to do to be real, but then also it's real on a side of things that we don't get to see because we think real is what the movies always show us. So showing them in the highest throes of a high where they're in a nodding off state, to not being that much later where they are functional enough to go out and walk and talk and do things, is probably a little more real than we may know about. And it's not something, even if it wasn't, it's the opposite of what you're normally used to seeing in movies that deal with this type of subject.
Well, yeah, because normally it's, we have to get to the downfall quickly. And it's like, we show some of the highs, but then it gets to be the real low lows and the shouting and the doing anything you've got to and the escalating things. It's like, this movie does escalate.
Yeah.
And these characters are doing what they have to get by. But there's the inherent humanity that's left in that, that's left with their, in their characters versus, you know, that you sort of strip that away in the more sensational versions, and it's just, oh, these poor broken souls, pity them. And then meanwhile, David writes this version, and it's like, you can feel pity for them. You can feel sorry for them, but they are normal people. You may be living near them. You may know them and you don't know it. And they could definitely use your help, but it's not like, don't just look at them like you're above on high and like, not so much judging, but just don't look at them like from on high when it's like, no, yeah, they're on the same level as us.
It's also something where it's easy to understand, though, that, and I'm going to say it in terms of the characters, because again, I don't know David personally, and I don't know how bad things got for him personally. But it's definitely something where it's almost as if they in some ways got lucky, because if they kept on with it, then yes, they probably would have been the typical stereotype of this type of character we were used to in film, which is, again, is a real thing. It happens to people. But
oh yeah, well, especially one of the last fixes that we see them going for, where like she spills the drugs on the floor and like this dirty bathroom.
Don't even remind me of that. Is that also intercut with him trying to find a place that would he be able to shoot?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That got me too.
Because that's like something where, but again, it's like they were still at a point where they, I'm not saying nobody's at a point where they're unsalvageable. I don't know for a fact. The only way that's the case is when somebody has gone so far that they are mentally broken, like they are somebody's been on the street for 50 years, you know, whatever it may be. But they were able to get to a point where they still were able to be bought back from that. And if it went further to a certain point, they probably not been able to ever come back. So it was kind of not lucky, but it was perfect timing for them, for those characters.
I mean, in its own sort of quippy little way, Late Night with the Devil and Animals are a good pair because they're both about being at a crossroads.
Yeah, I mean, it's so weird because they have nothing to do with each other, you know, besides David. But in the same breath, you know, of course, since demons are, as you know, we joke about it in the opening, saying, you know, we have internal and external demons, you know, like they're called internal demons for a reason, you know. It's based off of trying to humanize something that's mythological, because it's the parts that hurt us the most. So yeah, I mean, there are weird connections between these movies.
Besides the fact that David is just a consummate performer and fantastic in both, this is another one that I'm glad we got to discover.
You know, this is also something that, because again, you know, we're reaching out. It's like, what do we want to talk about? And I'm like, you know, for David, there's so many things we could technically do, but I don't know where it's going to go. And I kind of forgot, and I didn't forget Animals existed, but in the same breath, I forgot that he wrote it at the time. And so I'm just like, oh, you know, let him pick something. But then I'm like, wait, no, I'm going over it. You know what? Tell him we'll do Animals. Because it makes sense. And, you know, it's perfect. So that way, now when we have David back, he can pick something that he wants to talk about, whether, again, it's something of his own or something further, because we definitely got some important notices to people who here have to go and check out Late Night with the Devil when it comes out Friday, March 22nd. Or if you can't make it out and you're stuck, you know, just wait a little bit in a few weeks and you'll be able to watch it on Shudder starting April 19th. Sorry?
Oh, I was. You were going in at the same time as I got April 19th.
Oh, yeah, on April 19th. And then, you know, you can check out Animals if you need to watch it immediately, which you should. It is available to stream through certain sites, including Tubi. You know, gotta love Tubi.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'm iffy on the new design. Like
it is. I didn't know about it.
Yeah, it looks too much like Freevee's old design.
True.
It's like Freevee closed down, and now this happened. It's like, I love the old red Tubi with the. I mean, I'm not trying to logo shame here.
If it's just the design, I'm not going to be. You know, as long as everything else is the same, we're okay.
It's still very much Tubi, and in fact, using it on my tablet, it has the old icon and it has the whole find your rabbit hole thing. It has a cute little rabbit on the opening graphic, so I'm good. But yeah,
but after you've watched those, come back, let us know what you thought. But of course, to do that, you may need to find how to contact us. Mike, if people need to know how to contact us, how can they do that?
Well, if you want to summon the devilishly good time known as Overdue Rentals, social media is one of the ways you can do that, through platforms like TikTok and Instagram at Overdue Rentals Show. on Twitter at Rentals Overdue, and on Facebook at Overdue Rentals. If you want to email us love letters, incantations, and your favorite David Dastmalchian role, because there's so many of them to choose from, and the dude's versatile. I mean, did you remember he was in Blade Runner 2049?
Yes.
We did. Oh, we totally did. No, of course we did. I'm asking the audience. But you want to email us any of those sorts of details, those sorts of things? If you're a guest that wants to come on the show, email us at overdorentals@gmail.com. While you're on the internet, there is a wide back catalog of 97 episodes or 96. I always give or take one. You know, that's what happens when you miss a couple.
Maybe we'll just stop talking about it every time. We'll just drop the episode number.
Look, we have a lot of episodes out there, and we're bordering on 100. And I'm hoping we can do something special for 100, not 400. We're not at 400.
We'll do something special for 400 too.
We'll do something special. Yeah, we'll do something. You know what? Every episode is special. But you wouldn't know that unless you go back and listen to our back catalog on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Audible, wherever you ethically source your quality podcasts. Chances are the platform you're listening to us on right now, good place to catch us. And again, there's a lot of gems there. I mean, we had Thomas Hayden Church on recently, and... Thomas Hayden Church, Billy Zane, David.
You don't have Billy Zane though, but that's
no,
okay.
I'm assembling like a good horror panel to like do a big horror episode. That's what we'll do for episode 100. We'll get Billy Zane, we'll get Thomas Hayden Church back, David Dastmalchian. We'll get so many of our friends on here and just have fun. But you know, you can find our episodes out there, is what I'm trying to say. And while you are looking and listening to Overdue Rentals, you can rate, review, and subscribe to us, because we want to keep the rental counter open. We want to know what you want to hear. We want to know which episodes are the really good ones, which episodes are the pretty good ones. There are no bad episodes, so I'm not even going to solicit that in the slightest. And how dare you even suggest it? I mean, are you the devil? I think you should be thinking about that. I will also mention that Spotify, again, wonderful clutch feature that you can give us feedback on specific episodes. So again, is there a joke that you really liked? Is there a guest that you really liked? Tell us there. Tell us the emails. We have so many different ways that we can be reached, and you don't need to form a summoning circle. So that's it, dear listeners. We'd like to thank you all for showing up here tonight. Promotional consideration was paid for by the Plaza Hotel and FAO Schwartz. And until next week, I am your co-host, Mike Reyes, with Mr. Co-host Matthew Shuckman, and we're going to bid you all a fond farewell and
a non-conical production.
Bye-bye.
Worldwide Pants.